We're going to be going over Taxpayer Empowerment Act, Ag Credit for School Debt, State General Levy. That'll be led by Chair Drazkowski. I'll be handling two items after that. First, exemption and student loans. I will go over that. We do have a couple same and similars we can visit about for a bit if we want to, but before that, I would like to go back to some Senate provisions. And members, you should have
Not yet.
Okay, gotcha. So when we get finished with the House provisions, we'll be going over to some more Senate provisions to take a look at. And then just because we have the room from 2 to 5 doesn't mean we have to fulfill that. Senator Scoy. Okay, Senator Scoy is going to pass out some more Senate provisions for House File 848. And then we will go from there. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chair Drazkowski to look at the Taxpayer Empowerment Act, Ag Credit for School Debt. I believe Chair Drazkowski and Senator Coonan worked hard on that. And then the State General Levy, Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, just before we go do that, members, the purpose of this second list is if we have time. We were trying to work through the list that the Senate has of issues we wanted to bring up to the conference committee, understanding that, you know, by Monday we're going to be into our last week. And so Chair Davids and I had talked yesterday about a possibility of a Saturday meeting. We are trying to avoid that by thinking if we have time this afternoon, we'll get through some of these issues, and then we wouldn't have to meet on Saturday. So we'll see how it goes this afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Scoy. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Article 2 of the House bill is the Taxpayer Empowerment Act, and I think I may have talked a little bit about it the other day when we were talking about the Ag School Construction Finance Credit. I personally had visited over maybe it was exactly a dozen locations in January and February of session throughout the state, meeting with citizens, and we met with about 500 people. And in addition to that, we certainly heard from a good number of citizens, too, throughout the hearing process in the Property Tax Division in the House. And the three things that continued to come up and came up the most, although there were some discussions where there was isolated discussion about assessing and some other things, was number one, the property tax levy or spending by local units of government. I think the people realized, and they certainly expressed that in the meetings, that they were looking for some additional ways to provide some taxpayer oversight or control or influence, if you will, about the spending that they saw going on in their local communities. The other two items that we heard a lot about were the exorbitant business property taxes and specifically the state general levy and how that affected businesses, especially small businesses across our state. And the bulk of the meetings that we had were in greater Minnesota in the rural areas, although we had a couple of them in the suburbs as well. And the third area that we heard a lot about was farm property taxes, specifically that school construction levy that we talked about and that is reflected in number two on our sheet here as we move forward. The Taxpayer Empowerment Act actually includes three items. The first of them is the overall title piece, if you will, of the article, and that is to provide some input and influence that local property taxpayers can have into decisions that are happening within their local government around spending. And what this does is it provides that if the local unit of government in December, when it brings its certified levy forward, has a levy that is greater than the certified levy from the that was certified the year earlier, that the taxpayers would be empowered at that point to, if they decide to or if they want to, and I would argue that in many cases in which there was good communication between the local unit of government and their citizens, and that there was a good working relationship about the decisions being made, that that it really wouldn't be invoked. But in situations where it wasn't, and those local taxpayers would want to exert more influence on the process, they would be empowered then to seek out signatures in the form of petition signatures between that point in time and the following June from 10% of the voters from the last election in that jurisdiction. Should they receive that number of signatures and, or gather that number of signatures, the item would appear on the ballot in the following November, and then there would be a vote, an election in that following November that would be in the general election if it was an even-numbered year, and in a special election if it was an odd-numbered year, that would put the question to the voters in that area. And if the voters in their position won out in that, it would then in the following year's levy move that levy back to the point that it was 2 years prior, which was the original year that they were talking about. So it provides a reset, if you will, that the taxpayers can enact or invoke in their local jurisdiction if and when those situations occur where local units of government are spending beyond what is the comfortable level for the citizens of that area. So that's the overview of the provision, Mr. Chair. And I guess if anybody has any questions, we had good discussion on this, as you might expect and suspect. The local units of government are not supportive generally of this. This applies, by the way, to cities and counties, but not schools. This is one that I think the greatest ambassadors for this proposal are the people who are not in this room today, but the people who are home working and trying to, you know, make their communities and their families run smoothly. So with that, Mr. Chair, I guess at this point, any questions that people have? I might add also before we go to that, that this is the alternative that we saw in the House to state government imposed levy limits, one that empowers the most local control that you have, and that's the people. And so that's the idea and the design behind what I think is a real good proposal going forward.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question that I hadn't heard before, but is the first levy voted on and then that passes, and then later they can say they don't want it and repeal it back? Is that how it works? Or I'm trying to understand the repeal process, and part of the reason I'm asking that question is if they had moved ahead on major projects and then we rolled it back, what would be the ramifications? So help me understand that.
Chair Graskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gazalka, it doesn't do anything retroactively to things that were done in the past, so that when you get to that point in the election, the levy then that would be certified for that next year would be limited to the amount that was back during the time that was being originally discussed. And so that is the maximum levy at that point that could be instituted upon the citizens in that jurisdiction in that next year going forward.
Okay. Senator Gazalka?
Nope.
Chair Scoy?
It's interesting. I mean, I had the opportunity to serve on a county board, so I have some background in how local units, you know, respond to their constituencies. But I guess my question is more of just technical understanding of what's going on. And this is an actual example, and I'm wondering how the county board would have responded under this reverse referendum scenario. The county that I was serving on had a county hospital, and the county hospital was not breaking even. You know, many of the medical facilities are struggling in the rural areas. They eventually worked out an agreement to sell the hospital to another health care provider. Part of the sale agreement was a significant levy increase imposed upon the taxpayers of the county to pay off the past debts of the hospital. If they completed the sale and did the levy increase and the reverse referendum came on 2 years later, what would happen to the debts of the hospital and the sale that's contingent on the county having this mechanism in place to pay off the shortfall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Mr. Chair, Ms. Dalton could help us through the intricacies of that. But we did provide for exceptions for debt-related situations. I think she can address those the best.
Ms. Dalton, why don't you join us here so the senators don't have to turn that on. Ms. Dalton, did you hear Chair Stoy's question?
Mr. Chair, yes, I did. Senator Scoey, the bill as drafted basically allows when the referendum is put on, there's a maximum. There's either the voters can either approve the levy that came out in Truth and Taxation that year. If they don't, the levy becomes the non-debt levy from 2 years ago plus whatever is needed for debt. So it doesn't take you totally back to 2 years ago. It does allow whatever you need for debt. Now, if the reverse referendum is actually the petition is filed with the 10%, there's a moratorium on issuing new debt between the time that the reverse referendum is filed with the county and the time of the election. So nobody can kind of get around it by issuing new debt during that five-month period. But this doesn't hinge on anybody's ability to levy for existing debt.
So the impact on the sale of the hospital, where they weren't undertaking any new debt, they were putting a mechanism in place with their levy to pay off what were shortfalls in the operation of the hospital, wouldn't have been impacted by this?
Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoey, if this is not a debt issue, it's an operating expenditure issue, yes, it could be impacted.
And so, Chair, or Ms. Dalton, or what would be the speculation then on, would the sale then have to be undone? Because the levy to pay off the shortfall went away.
Mr. Chair, the sale wouldn't necessarily have to be undone. It would be that the county would either have to have educated its voters so its voters would have approved having this increased levy to cover that cost, or if the referendum fails, then the county is going to have to make the choices within the county budget on where it's spending its non-debt levy.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, and Chair Scoey, and that certainly wouldn't preclude the county from then borrowing at that point. I wouldn't expect to cover that. Is that right, Ms. Dalton?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, the moratorium on bonding is only for that five-month period from June when the petition for referendum is filed and the actual election in November.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Druskowski, it appears like it's making a fairly cumbersome process for local elected boards to contemplate if they're going to be setting budgets and then, you know, in the future having them undone. I mean, you know, we all take different approaches. I would recommend if the voters didn't like the actions that I took as a county commissioner, they could vote for my opponent in the next election. But anyway, it's interesting to contemplate.
Okay, let's go to, I think we'll go through 1, 2, and 3, and then let the department respond to the issue kind of in the division report, if that's okay.
Sure.
Okay, Chair Drazkowski, item 2.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still on item 1.
Oh, still on item 1.
Yes, there's two more subcomponents of item 1, and that is there's two of them. They're related to the local elections. They also have connections to local elections. First is a set of special elections that moves not all but most, almost all, local government special elections to the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November. Now, there were some exceptions placed in there, and we also placed exceptions for disaster or emergency at the request of both the cities and the counties, and those are placed in there. And I'm trying to remember, Mr. Chair, there were like 26 or so sections to the original bill, so I'm guessing it's probably 20 to 25 different local government elections we're looking at there that are moved to that November election.
Chair Stoyer.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, do these provisions also just apply to cities and towns, not to schools?
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Skoy, no, it does apply to schools as well. So school construction levies are included in here as well. And I don't know if there are other school-specific measures in here or not, but there's a bunch of them.
Chair Skoy.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would have a question. Maybe staff could help us. What about the statutory operating debt exemption that schools have, where if they're an SOD, they can hold the elections in a shorter time period because they're under these financial issues?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair Drazkowski.
Yeah, we contemplated that, Chair Skoy, and that is not in here. At one point it was, and then we removed it from the bill. Also, the other part that was removed from the bill with that was restrictions on mail-in balloting, and so that is not in the bill or affected by the bill either.
Chair Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The third subcomponent of item number 1 is a Representative Runbeck bill, and this affects, looks at and contemplates the approaches that local units of government, and I'm talking specifically here about cities and counties, have in their ability in their approach to building buildings. And we have in statute now a capital improvement process in statute, and members, behind that capital improvement process lies a reverse referendum that should the local unit of government be approaching the construction of a jail or a city hall or another building like that, and not have the support of their taxpayers, the taxpayers have the ability or the recourse at that point to exercise a reverse referendum. What we are seeing in a pattern of things we've seen is that both cities and counties have at times, and it may even seem to be increasing, realized that extra, they may have looked at it as an inconvenience or a burden at times, the reverse referendum, because what they are doing instead is going to lease purchase financing, utilizing the bonding capacity of either the EDA or the HRA, and that does not have the same reverse referendum behind it. And we are seeing cities and counties moving and doing that, even in the face of the reality that the capital improvement process money is cheaper than the HRA and the EDA money is. They're still going over to that. So what Representative Runbeck's bill does is it provides the same reverse referendum capacity for the voters placed behind those lease purchase agreements that cities and counties would do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, number 2 is the item that we talked about at an earlier meeting about the agricultural school debt piece in here. We affectionately refer to it, since we don't have the house, garage, and an acre bill in here. We refer to it as the house, garage, and half your acres. And so that's this item number two. We talked about it. It's about $50 million a year. And what it does is it provides that the state government would provide payment to the school district for an amount equivalent to one-half of the non-house garage and 1 acre that the house garage and garage are sitting on. In other words, the rest would provide for the payment for all of the, or half of the, acreage beyond the house and garage and 1 acre that it sits on. Within that jurisdiction, it applies to 2A, 2B, and 2C land. And then a notation would be made on the property tax statement for those individuals as to the amount, and those individuals would then turn around and file an income tax for an income tax credit in that same amount on their income taxes the following year.
Is there a homestead requirement, or just for everybody?
Chair Daskowski.
Mr. Hines is shaking his head no, so the answer is no, Chair Scott.
Okay, let's go to item three, and then we will go to member questions, and we'll go to the department for some comments. Chair Daskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Item three is, as I mentioned, the three things that we heard predominantly throughout the state. One of those three was concerns about our small businesses in Minnesota and their ability to compete, and there was really a palpable fear and fatigue, if you will, amongst not only people who own businesses, but even people who owned bare commercial property, and the high levels of taxation that they were unable to burden, and the identification among those people we talked to about the state general levy being one that we would have the ability as a legislature to clearly and cleanly influence and remove the 25% to 40% of the property tax burden that represents for those property taxpayers is represented in the state general levy provision that we have in the bill. It has the first what it does is it exempts for commercial industrial properties it exempts, it actually repeals is a proper term. It repeals the state general levy on the first $500,000 of value of that business. And then for the seasonal recreational property, it similarly repeals the first $250,000 of tax on that $250,000 of value on that business. And that is provided in the current biennium, and that amounts to about $450 million, give or take. And then the bill also repeals the inflator, and it also then goes on to repeal the remaining portions of the state general levy each year. By the year 2022, those businesses would be freed from the burdens that this high tax levy is providing to them.
Thank you, Chair Daskowski. Questions from members?
We have
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the first phase where you would remove the first $500,000 of value, was there any calculation of where that would move us in comparison to other states? I know in rural we're calculated at number two as highest business property tax, number five for the state. Anybody calculate where that might put us with other states?
Chair Daskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Gazelka, no, not that I am aware of. Mr. Haveman might be able to, that might be a good inquiry to make to him. But you're right. In rural Minnesota, number two highest for commercial and industrial property taxation. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. But I undoubtedly it would move us down the direction we want to go on that one, but I don't know to what point.
Questions from Chair Scoy?
Thank you. And not wanting to debate handouts, but I think that the handout on Minnesota being the highest or second highest has some flaws in the methodology. I mean, they picked Glencoe, said we're going to compare that against X city elsewhere, not taking into account personal property taxes somewhere else and elsewhere. So please, we'll try to keep the, I won't go there anymore on that. But I do have a question with regard to the inflator on the seasonal statewide business tax levy. Oops, I'm sorry. And with regard to the inflation index, and if we were to repeal the inflator on the statewide general levy, you know, it would be the only class of property that doesn't have an adjustment based on what's happening in the economy. I mean, homeowners and, as we know, ag land, as their values go up, their adjustments go up. And so I think that we need to think about the policy of what we're doing there. The Senate took a more, we took a, you know, a concern about property taxes, and we did reduce the statewide business levy. It's a one-time reduction. And then we did take a modest rate change so that that relief then spreads on to all of the classes of property, homeowners, ag land, CI, on our runs, everybody but the railroads, because of a different provision, receives some form of property tax relief. And so we are trying to figure out a mechanism that if we're doing this change, which is property tax relief, that it would spread a little broader. I, you know, we don't have to debate the history of it, but let me just briefly say that when this statewide business property tax levy was implemented, it was part of a much larger plan that came apart through the Ventura years. And part of that was pretty significant rate compression. In exchange for the rate compression, rate changing from, I think it was 3.4 going to 2 and 2.45 going to 1.5, the statewide business property tax was imposed. And then the inflator was put on it to adjust for some increases in value. And if the rate had been frozen at the same rate that was imposed in 2002 when this was implemented, I mean, the property taxes would be significantly higher than they currently are on that class of property. If you look at the, you know, the increases that other classes have had, it's, you know, 80%. CI is 40%. So if we're going to do property tax relief, I would encourage us to do it in a broader manner than just targeting one small category, and hopefully we'll be able to have property tax relief for, you know, all of the folks in our communities. So I don't know, that isn't much of a question. I guess it's more just a comment.
Mr. Chair.
Chair
Grasshopper. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I have a handout that includes the effect of the House bill on the state general tax for both C&I properties and seasonal rec. Those would be columns 2 and 3 by county on here, and then columns 3 and 4, I'm mistaken. And then column 5 is the effect of the of number 2 on our sheet, the ag credit. So there's really quite a bit of information in this sheet outlined by county and showing how much each of these counties would benefit from the direct tax relief that we provide for them in these good provisions in the House bill. And Chair Scoia, I would just, I guess, to your question or maybe comment, I would just say, you know, I think it's our belief that we want to, instead of exacting a bunch of shifts and other things within here, just simply providing and removing the tax burden directly to the people who are paying it. And those people who are paying it are the ones who I have heard, as they try to stay alive in our state, the greatest amount of anxiety and fatigue throughout the state. You know, I on the House floor talked about the Sunrise Cafe in Malmo, and the lady there, multi-generational. They have a convenience store and gas station. You know, we've got them all across your district and mine and Senator Clunin's and everybody in rural Minnesota. And she sold the business once and then took it back a year and a half because they couldn't make a go. As we know, especially in the northern part of the state, many of these businesses are only open or able to actually function very well half the year when the tourism season is going on. But, you know, in that business, they were paying $12,000 a year on a $460,000 valued property, and $4,200 of that, or 35% of their property tax burden, was the state general levy. And what this is doing is providing the Sunrise Cafes in every one of our districts, all 134 of them across Minnesota, the type of property tax relief that they not only need but deserve, so that they can start to get up on their feet again, maybe up to their knees first and then to their feet, and hopefully start to walk and someday run. So that's what we hope to do, and that was a discussion we had in the House, but appreciate it.
Chair Spahn.
No, thank you, Chair Davids. And Representative Drazkowski, clearly we'd like to be supportive of our small businesses and also the customers that frequent that business. I do appreciate that you are dealing with the seasonal rec as you are looking at the CI component. Senate took a little different approach, but we did have a conversation in the Senate, and I don't want to spend a lot of time because it's kind of not our day on this, but as long as we're talking about the statewide business levy and the seasonal rec component, what we did is we looked at the seasonal rec component, figuring that we have had conversations in the past about what happens to school districts when you remove that value from them. And the policy argument is that while these individuals are seasonal, they're just there part-time in the summer, they don't have a chance to have impact into the school elections, we should be exempting them from the school building levies. And so we, you know, that was the conversation when this was implemented, and we've had bills in the past to try to put some of that value back into the school districts to help schools operate and have been unsuccessful. But the approach we took this year was to say, okay, for seasonal rec, stay where you are. But if you're in a higher valued place, over $300,000, it's clearly not a seasonal rec facility. It's not going to be freezing up in the wintertime. It's more of a residence. And so we did a split classification on those, where if you're over $300,000 in value, you would be in the residential. It would be taxed as if it was non-homestead residential. The lower valued would remain where they are. And so we took a little different tact at that. But we did also take a little approach at the seasonal rec component of the statewide business property tax as we did a one-time reduction in the statewide general levy, one-time ongoing. So we reduced it over the biennium, $93 million. So pretty significant reduction in number. We, as I've argued, left the inflator in place, but we did have a reduction in the statewide business levy, and then this other change that has a $9 million impact to it because we split class some of the seasonal rec properties.
Thank you, Senator. Let's go to the department, and then I will pick up 4 and 5. We'll have discussion on that, and the department can comment on 4 and 5, and then we'll go to some Senate provisions here. Commissioner Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. With respect to item 1, the Taxpayer Empowerment Act, We do have some concerns that this proposal would cause some instability for local governments, as was discussed at your table. As they do engage in their budgeting process, this might create some uncertainty for them. There are existing mechanisms that involve voters in keeping their property taxes low. For example, the truth in taxation hearings are one such method. And unfortunately, they in some areas do have low turnout, and one solution might be to increase the interest and awareness of these hearings so that they can be more productive and achieve the intended goal of helping citizens be involved in the budget setting for their local governments. And finally, we would note that there is a concern that these reverse referendums might have the unintended consequence of their intent, because if local governments are concerned that the referendum process might result in a lower levy, they might artificially increase their levy at the front end in anticipation of that kind of change. And so it could create increasing the higher level earlier on, so that later in later years, referendums could bring them back to that level, which is actually perhaps a little bit higher than they need. And we did note at the department that that has actually already happened when the legislature enacts levy limits, that the reaction to that is to go right up to that levy limit. So we do have some concerns about the proposal, and would be happy to continue any conversations that we might be useful in for that. With respect to the agricultural credit for school debts, this, as was mentioned yesterday, there is a great concern about agricultural values, and we do understand that. We have concerns about this proposal because it may be very confusing to taxpayers. They are used to addressing their property tax issues with respect to their property tax statement, and then perhaps through a PTR, property tax refund approach. Moving this credit to their income tax might be very confusing for taxpayers, and so we would want to try to minimize that potential confusion. The other issue that is raised by this proposal is that, as you noted earlier, there is not a homestead attached to this credit. And so, for example, if there were six families, sometimes when land is passed down, particularly a farm, it may be passed to a number of members of the next generation. And so if there were four owners of that property, it may be difficult for the department to verify who is appropriately taking that credit. Are they supposed to split that amongst the four owners and take it on in their individual property tax issue or statements? And then how might the department be able to verify that to ensure that the intent of your legislation could be complied with? And then finally, Mr. Chair and members, with respect to the state general levy, this provision does phase in over 6 years, and according to House fiscal documents, ultimately it will cost the state over $2.1 billion when it is fully phased in. And as I testified before the House when we heard this provision, that is a significant concern for the long-term budget of the state, and it essentially puts the state in at risk for deficits going into the future. The recipients, as you've noted, the document that you passed out with respect to Metro and Greater Minnesota totals.
That is the result of electronic devices on the tables. You can shut those off.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue, Commissioner.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, as I looked at the first column of the document that you passed out, it appears that the state levy this year is about $816 million, and about 66% of that is carried in those metro counties, and 34% in Greater Minnesota. And so as fully phased in, it would be ultimately eliminating the entire levy, which, again, gets to almost about $1 billion per year. Obviously, this run doesn't go out into those years, but I would expect that those relative ratios would carry. And so the metro counties would see 60% of that, 60% of that relief, if you will, would be going to those larger metro counties rather than to Greater Minnesota. And as Chair Skoy has mentioned, when the general levy was enacted, it was an attempt to take a balanced approach to have this levy in place and to reduce some rates. This is not a balance change. It just eliminates the levy altogether. So we would have serious concerns about the long-term budget impact of this phase-out of the state general levy. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I will go into members of the conference committee into 4 and 5. Quite a large part of House File 848 is the personal exemption. And basically what we're doing, we're basically modeling after the federal $4,000 exemption. We're simply taking 25% of that so that this would be one that every taxpayer in Minnesota receives a $1,000 exemption, and that spreads it to everybody, rural, metro, suburban, every Minnesotan would be able to take advantage of that. So that's a bit very straightforward on that. Item 5, student loan. Oh, yes, members, you have a sheet in your packet. It's actually two pages. It says in the upper left there, 25% of personal exemption amounts. So it goes through by county, how each members of each county benefit. And, of course, one could say there's more in the 7-county metro, and that'd be kind of like because there's more people in the 7-county metro. But it's equal to every individual across the state. Item 5, student loan credit. Maybe Ms. Manzi could come to the table here. This is one that I kind of, at first when I thought of the concept, I wasn't real big on it. But as we looked into it further, I've kind of become a champion of it. What it says is you have someone that lives in Minnesota that has student loan debt, and we put a formula in place that allows them to get a credit for that to reduce their student loan debt. And in effect, what we're doing is we're bringing folks in with college educations that want to start their career here, want to build a business here, want to raise their families here, and we kind of think that's a good thing to do. So, but Ms. Manns, if you kind of go through for the conference committee the formula of how we do this.
Mr. Chair, members of the conference committee, I don't know if you all have the one-page sheet on the student loan credit. You do. Okay. Very good. So this credit is intended to offset both principal and interest payments made during the year. So it is greater if you have more payments that you make during the year. It's also greater if you have lower income. It has a three-part calculation. The first part is to set aside a portion of your income, so a protected part of your income, which will not be used to calculate the phase-out. And in the bill, that amount is $10,000. So the first $10,000 of your income doesn't apply to the phase-out. And then your loan gets reduced, or your total amount of credit gets reduced by 10% of your adjusted gross income over that $10,000. So if you look to the middle of the page, it will say that for this example taxpayer, the credit equals $3,000, which is the least of three things. And the first thing is the adjusted gross income minus the $10,000 protected amount. And this is for an example taxpayer who has $30,000 of earnings. So $20,000 is the amount that gets applied against the phase-out. You take 10% of that, which is $2,000, and you subtract that from the amount of interest and principal payments that you make during the year. For this individual, that's assumed to be $5,000 of payments, and that results in a $3,000 credit. The other two components that get used are what the earned income is of the taxpayer and spouse. So you have to be working and have some income in order to get this credit. For this example, we set that at $30,000, which is greater than the $3,000 in the first component. And the third component was added over concerns that someone with low incomes would see this credit as an opportunity to borrow money from their family and friends and pay off the total amount of a very large loan all at once in order to get a very big credit in 1 year. So we capped it at the actual amount of interest paid during the year and 10% of the original loan amount, or the amount that you actually borrowed. Now, if you look down at the tables at the bottom, it sort of shows you how all that somewhat complicated formula works. And you see that for someone with a lower total amount of loan payments during the year, so in the leftmost example column for someone who has $2,000 of loan payments, as you go up through the income range, once you got over around $20,000 or so of income, you would no longer get a credit. So the person with $20,000 of income would get a credit for $1,000 of their loan payments. Now, in the middle column, the loan payments are somewhat higher. They're $5,000 a year. And you see how the credit ramps down as income goes up. The final column, the loan payment, is even higher. It's $8,000 a year. So now we're getting into someone who had taken on a lot of debt. And you see how it extends then to higher income levels. So the credit calculation sort of is more generous if you have more debt, and it's more generous if you have a lower income. Let's see, and then the Department of Revenue estimates show that there would be just over 100,000 returns that would be eligible for this credit. And the average credit would be just under $600 in tax year 2015.
Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Senator Rest?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering why you only provide an example of a single taxpayer as opposed to a married filing joint.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I only provided an example of a single taxpayer because I wanted to keep this on one page. I'd be happy to make an example for a married couple for you.
Yep. No, it's fine.
Senator Rest.
I was just wondering.
Yep. Thank you. Senator Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we look at this graph, I just looked at the first example that looked like there's about $2,200 in interest in the credit's about $1,000. So what would have happened if you just exempted half the interest? I mean, how does that all, is there some way to make this simpler so it's, you know, I understand the idea about giving these folks that have borrowed money some assistance as they try to climb out of that and try to, you know, start their families, et cetera. But I just was curious if there was a way to make this a little simpler.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, I think the idea was to craft this as a credit that would offset liability rather than an exemption, which would just reduce taxable income. A reduction in taxable income, the benefit of that to a taxpayer is going to be whatever their marginal rate is, so 5.35, 7.05, 7.85, or 9.85%. A credit such as this, however, you know, you see in the example where the person is making $5,000 of loan payments and they end up with a $3,000 credit, that has a much greater impact. So that was the decision to go with a credit rather than a deduction. There also were some proposals in the House this year for deductions of principal payments. There is a deduction allowed at the federal level for student loan interest payments, which is subject to an income-based phase-out, and that goes into the calculation of federal taxable income, which flows through to Minnesota's income tax. So we already conform to the federal deduction for a portion of interest payments, and this credit would be in addition to that.
Senator Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Manzi. And so then the loan payments, the other question, I guess, the loan payments don't really have anything to do with whether it's a 20-year time frame or whether they have 5 years left. It's just loan payments.
Ms. Manzi?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, that's correct. It's however much you made in loan payments during that taxable year. I guess going back to your previous question, the other element that I failed to mention is that this is crafted as a refundable credit. So for a lower-income person who has a large amount of student, has to pay a lot in student loans and doesn't end up having any state tax liability because their income isn't that high at this point in their career, they would receive the credit as a refund. And that's another reason that the House author chose to craft this as a refundable credit rather than a subtraction from taxable income.
Senator Scott? Okay, let's go.
I have a question.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How do you administer it? Because I'm thinking interest is an easy one to follow because you have to record that. You get a 1099. But you don't really get loan payments. I'm just wondering how you track it.
Ms. Manson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, I think the individual would know how much they had paid during the year on their loans. They would have their loan statements, and then the Department of Revenue could, you know, request those for the returns that they chose to review as part of their compliance efforts.
Senator Gazelka?
That's fine. I guess I was thinking, yeah, that makes sense, because I thought even kind of along Senator Scoy's line, Mr. Chair, I was thinking maybe just say two times the interest is your deduction, and you know that's an easy thing to track.
And one of the reasons, as the House looked at, we thought that this could be a recruiting tool for our businesses that have talent shortages. I mean, the talent they're looking for, they're going to be coming out of colleges and universities from across the country. And we can refer some of our folks to Minnesota because we say, hey, look at this. And you got some student debt. We're going to help with that.
Sure. Thank you. And one more comment, because I like the idea. I think you're exactly right on that. We put all this money into helping kids go to college here, and there's no guarantee they stay in Minnesota. They go somewhere else. So I like the idea of rewarding the folks that have a college degree that want to come to Minnesota and stay in Minnesota. I like the idea. I'm just trying to figure out how to make it work best.
And these are college-educated folks, so they'll be able to calculate it. Hopefully, because they're going to need it. But no. And of course, this is this will be up for discussion. And if there's some things we can do to make it work better, we'll certainly want to look at that. So, with that, to Senator Scoy.
Just briefly before we go to the commissioner, I wanted to go back just very quickly to the personal exemptions. The one thing that I am like about the proposal is the one-time nature of it, as opposed to some of the proposals that have these huge ongoing tails costs. This is a manageable level. So we do have some attraction to that part of this proposal.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Ms. Manzi. Commissioner Bowerly on parts 4 and 5, and then we'll go to some Senate provisions here. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. With respect to the personal exemption, we agree that with the comment that was just made about the fact that it is a one-time cost, and so it does not we do not have the long-term budget implication cost that exists in some other proposals. We would note that this would go to everyone, and there is certainly some attraction to that, but we also know that middle-class Minnesotans need tax relief, and one of the governor's proposals was the Working Family Credit, which was aimed at lower- and middle-income families. Helping families get into the middle class and stay in the middle class is important to our economy, and so we think that targeted tax relief is certainly important as well. With respect to the student loan credit, certainly, student debt is a problem, and affording college and or a two-year degree is very important, particularly as our businesses need skilled labor. That's why the governor has proposed a tuition freeze to keep the price of tuition down at Minnesota universities and colleges at the MNSU system to try to cut off this problem at the front end. Certainly, we understand the challenge, and I would note that I have personally been lobbied on this particular proposal by people who would benefit from this idea of having their student loans be helped to be paid. That said, the tuition freeze would actually stop this problem at the front end. We do want to note and particularly thank Ms. Manzi for the work that she's done with the department over the last few days to work on some of the administrative concerns that we have with the that we have shared with the memo. So we appreciate your openness to hearing issues of administrability. So thank you.
Thank you. And to the tuition freeze part, I think most folks kind of like that idea. But what this does is, yes, the tuition freeze helps at the front end, but it doesn't help Minnesota business recruit folks that are out of college that actually have to as far as the recruiting team. So, Representative Swiecinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just kind of another thought kind of going along that same caveat. When we're looking at, we were talking yesterday about kind of the workforce housing portion and how we calculate that. I think the Senate provision, look at who would be qualifying for that, like a 4% vacancy rate. I think our position was a 3% vacancy rate. And it would be interesting some thought to talk with Representative Norris's committee, and I forget who is the higher ed chair over in the Senate.
Bona.
But looking at, you know, if we're looking at a credit, we're looking at some of those things, if there's a way, you know, as a reimbursable credit to address that, but look at vacancy rates within industry. To say, you know, hey, if you've got, you know, to really be able to target those majors that are exceptionally having a wider gap of job vacancy versus people able to fill them, to maybe even target that even a little further, might be an interesting conversation to have as we move this forward. But appreciate the.
Thank you. On that, unless there's other member questions, I think we'll go to Senator Scoy. If you would like to present, do you just want to start at the top and go down, or what's best for you?
Oh, Chair Davids, what I would think is what we've done is went through some of the provisions that the Senate included that were from the governor, and I think that if the department, Commissioner Bowerly, would want to talk about the governor's railroad, the governor's corporate reforms, and a few of the others, I think it would be best if we heard from Commissioner Bowerly on these proposals, and we'll go from there. The bottom four are a few sales tax exemption items. If we have time, I don't think it would take very long, and then you know, we could pick those up. But I think to start with, let's go to Commissioner Bowerly.
I think that's a very good idea. Commissioner Bowerly, do you have the where we're at here? So why don't we just start with number one, Commissioner Bowerly? And so, members, these are governor's positions or proposals, one through six. And so why don't we just start with one, stop for questions, two, stop for questions, and we'll work our way through that. I think it's a very good idea to get some of the governor's proposals out on the table here, too. Senator Ress?
Mr. Chairman, just to be clear, they are in our bill, these provisions, this first six.
You put some of the governor's provisions in your bill?
We certainly did.
You did?
So did we. You got some good ones.
Got some good ones.
Okay, Commissioner Bowerly.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Scoy.
I would. I think Commissioner Bowerly should be free to talk about provisions in either bill.
I think we can do that. Let's go through what we have here. And as far as the House goes, probably the biggest one is the child care tax credit, and then there are others. But let's go through the Senate ones here first, and we could certainly do that. Commissioner Bowerly, item one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We do appreciate the opportunity to talk again about the governor's proposals. I think when I presented them to each committee initially, it was about 45 minutes, so I'll try to be slightly briefer than that here today, seeing nodding from the table. Modernizing railroad property.
With that, if I don't know if some House research folks might just be able to put together quickly all of the fine provisions that the governor had that we put in the House bill. I know some of them kind of various subject areas and maybe a handwritten list. We might not get to them today, but I just so the committee knows kind of where we're at. Commissioner Bauer, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first item is modernizing railroad property taxes. The statute in Minnesota asks the department to get to market value in its assessment of railroad property. Because, however, our current statute and rule also require us to use outdated methodology, our department personnel, who are experts in valuation and assessment, are not able to get to market value at this point with respect to railroad property. And so just an example of that is the current method that is prescribed to value railroad property is called the Wisconsin Blue Chip Method, and it's one point in time was an industry standard. Today, however, no state other than Minnesota uses it, even Wisconsin. In addition, the governor is proposing to expand the taxable property base to include rolling stock, which includes locomotives and cars for railroads, in addition to their trestles and bridges. And Minnesota is one of a handful of states that does not currently include rolling stock in its taxation of railroad property. These changes would be made at the state level, and then because railroads also do pay at the local jurisdictions, those jurisdictions would generally rely upon the department's assessment and allocation of those values. They would also see a potential increase in they could either increase the levy to capture that value, or other players on that levy would see relief at the local level. May I answer any questions?
Sure. Questions for members?
Well, you guys should have questions. I don't think I heard from you in committee what you thought about when the railroad industry came up and said, we'll basically take you to court, we've never lost. I wanted to get your perspective on that, because if we do move forward with this, and I want some, I want to get your feel for it.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Gazelka. The 4R Act, which is the federal law that governs this area, prohibits states from discriminating against railroads based on unique rates or particularly targeted taxes. We are not imposing a wheelage tax or anything specific to railroads in this proposal, and we do not believe that it violates the 4R Act. We understand, because the railroads have told us in committee and in meetings at the department, that they do plan on litigation. We anticipated that. That is typically how it goes in most states, and so we, of course, did consider those issues as we prepared this proposal.
Thank you. Thank you, Zelka. Other questions from members on item one? Please, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are several provisions in the corporate reform set. One is a smaller version of an R&D change, particularly relative to the changes in R&D that are carried in either of your bills. This one is an administrative issue that has come up at the department, where companies who began their investment in research and development a long time ago may no longer have records from the 1980s to support their base year of research and investment. And so the department is in the position of disallowing the credit in its entirety in that instance. This would allow companies to have a credit of allowed them to take the minimum credit, having a 16% base year for the minimum credit, if they have documentation to establish a lower base percentage in their base year, they could certainly take a larger credit, but it provides more companies with access to this credit. The proposal also modifies the definition of financial institution to ensure that all of the particular entities that exist in our legal landscape can be included in this definition. The proposal in the Senate bill and from the governor includes non-admitted insurance companies in the combined unitary business return. This is a proposal that addresses the gap in which businesses we are seeing have been using to shift income previously subject to corporate income tax to a qualifying insurance company. And I want to be clear that these are not insurance companies that provide any insurance services to Minnesotans. They are not collecting premiums. They are structured as an insurance company, but they are not selling premiums, and so they're not paying the premium tax that regular insurance companies would. These are non-admitted insurance companies. The next provision deals with the acceleration of the gain on the sale of business. This provision would put into time the context of the sale of the business, as opposed to allow a delay in the realization of the gain of that sale. What it is attempting to do is ensure that the transaction as it occurs, for example, in selling a business, is realized here in Minnesota where that business transaction took place, as opposed to realizing the gain several years later when an individual may no longer live in Minnesota. When the transaction does take place here in Minnesota, we need to make sure that Minnesota is benefiting from that transaction and not avoiding the tax related to it by moving to a place outside of Minnesota.
Commissioner, people are doing that? I hadn't thought of that.
Mr. Chairman, we don't like to give you ideas.
Well, if you'd finish, I'm sorry. Let's finish that number two, and then I do have a question.
Sure. Mr. Chairman and members, the next provision would exclude the sale of derivatives from the apportionment factor. This would clarify how income from businesses are allocated to the state. The next provision removes an unintended additional benefit to corporations which receive dividends from debt-financed stock. And from the current statute. And I will note for you that we have department experts here in the room, so if you have detailed questions on any of these provisions, we can go into more depth on them. And then finally, the last provision deals with a concept called economic substance, and a number of states have the ability to look at the character of a transaction, and if the transaction was designed solely to evade tax, that the state could go back and and restrict that kind of transaction or organizational structure. So it would include a penalty for using transactions or organizational structures that do not serve a business purpose. Those are the set of corporate reform provisions that are in the governor's proposals and are in the Senate bill.
Thank you, Commissioner. Some interesting concepts. There are a couple of them. So I have a business, and I sell. How can I defer paying taxes on that? I mean, that's what people are doing.
So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, were you to sell your business to me in this tax year, and then you moved to Florida, and we structured that sale so that I would not pay you for that business until after you had established residency in another state, you could avoid paying Minnesota taxes on that. And again, Mr. Chairman, I would prefer that I don't give any particular ideas.
I'm taking note of that one.
Is that legal?
So, Mr. Chair.
Chair Drazkowski.
So, Mr. Chair, does that mean people actually leave the state to avoid taxes?
Rare case. I'm intrigued also by, and you know, some of these sound kind of interesting, actually. The insurance, you set up an insurance company, Shifting Sands Mutual, someplace, let's say, and you, what are they doing now? They're pumping a bunch of money into that insurance company that's not really providing insurance services. And so the money that goes in there, they don't have to pay the premium tax on? What's the scam here?
So insurance companies, and I'm looking at Mr. Iden on this one, or is this Mr. Mahoney? Could I ask one of our department lawyers to help explain the details of this proposal,
sure.
Mr. Chairman?
And what's your name, sir?
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeremy Iden, E-I-D-E-N, and I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
How can I do this, or how does this work?
So... So a company would set up a separate company and call it an insurance company. They may even offer insurance to members of the unitary group only, say flood insurance, and then also put other intangibles within that company. Any payments to that company would be deductible by the business because we can't include that insurance company in the unitary group. So it's a way of treating that insurance company the same way we treat other members of the unitary group. There's no intercompany transfers that can be deducted.
Okay, interesting. Questions from members? Thank you, sir. With that, if we can go to item three. Commissioner Barber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Item three is the solid waste management proposal. This deals with construction and demolition waste, and Minnesota's rate has remained the same for nearly 20 years. And what the goal of this is to align the tax of construction and demolition waste by ton with the tax by volume. Right now, these materials can be taxed either by volume or by ton, and that different rate can allow for different taxation for the same types of materials. And so this proposal would simply attempt to align those so that regardless of how they're being measured, the rate would be the same.
Okay. Questions for members? On item three. Commissioner, let's go to item four.
Item four is relates to the estate capture, estate tax recapture provision. The department has noticed there have been a few of these instances, so it's not a very wide set of customers who would be impacted by this, but we think it is important to clarify in the law that where a taxpayer has inherited, for example, farm property, and is subject to the estate tax, the law requires an heir to retain ownership and maintain tillable farm land for 3 years after the decedent's death. We have noticed a few instances where, as a result of eminent domain, that family does not have tillable land because there may now be a road there or a football field or something like that, and we don't want them to be punished as a result of that and subject to the estate recapture because it is not within their control that they no longer have tillable farmland. And so the proposal would remove the recapture tax if the farmland was acquired by the government unit through eminent domain. And so this would ensure fairness for taxpayers.
Okay. to house research, do we have that provision in the house tax bill? Why not? I missed that's a good one. I like that. That's really very good. I missed that one. Let's move same and not similar. The gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Commissioner Bowerly or staff. Kind of going along that same line, reminded of a situation where your provision talks about eminent domain capture and sale. What if, from an inheritance standpoint and taxation, if it was to be donated?
I am going to, Mr. Mahoney, O'Mahoney? Okay. Mr. Chairman, if you're amenable, I'd like to ask another one of our lawyers
Certainly.
To help answer the question.
Please state your name and be represented for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John O'Mahoney. I'm an attorney, and I represent the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you. And if I could ask you to repeat your question, I'm sorry.
Gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mahoney?
O'Mahoney.
O'Mahoney. All right. The question was... based just on the from acquisition to government, whether it was to be purchased or how that would affect the affected family or heir if it was to be donated. So say someone inherited a piece of property but donated it without intimate domain being called in.
So we did consider this. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you. We did consider this, and the way that the proposal is drafted, if the property is acquired by a government entity or a government unit that has the power of eminent domain and the property is going to be used for a public purpose, it qualifies to escape recapture. So it doesn't actually have to be seized in a government eminent domain proceeding, so long as it's for a public use.
Other questions on item 4? Okay, item 5, Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Item 5 deals with the home office deduction that taxpayers are allowed to claim on their property tax refund. In 2013, the IRS changed the way that taxpayers may calculate the portion of their home that is allowed for their home office, and we need to update the property tax refund to ensure that when you do have a home office, that portion is not allowed under your property tax refund claim. That is intended to be for the residential portion of your property and not the office. And right now, as it stands, taxpayers have a choice about how they calculate their office portion, and under one calculation, the full amount is available under the property tax refund, and the other is not. So we want to make sure that everyone is treated the same, and that we are keeping in keeping with the property tax refund goals of allowing for this refund for the residential portion, but not the office portion of someone's property.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Commissioner Bowerly, how would that affect for the renter's credit?
Would there be a recalculation?
Commissioner Bowerly? Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, if you could give us one moment to consult on that. We're not sure that it does, but we want to be accurate.
Let's go on and we'll come back to that. Item 6, or any other questions on home office calculation? Well, Mr. Collins?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Collins?
There will be no effect. It will just continue to be a straight percentage.
Okay. Gentleman from Lyon? Okay, let's go to item 6, Governor's proposal, senior deferral. Article 2, Sections 24 and 25 of the Senate bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Barley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This proposal updates an existing program in Minnesota. Senior citizens who may need help with their property tax payments can apply under this program to get some relief from the state. Ultimately, the state helps us with those payments and then is made whole at the end of the day when either that property is sold or the senior can repay the state for that assistance with their property taxes. However, we have noticed that there is not as much participation in this program as we believe there is actually need, and one of the reasons is that the deadline for application at this point in the statute is November 1st. And unfortunately, I'm sorry, I have that backwards. Currently, it is July 1st, and many seniors don't realize that they may have trouble paying their property taxes until they get their second half statement in October. And so by moving the application deadline to November 1st, we believe we will be able to help many more of those. We do receive calls from seniors who are not able, who haven't met that July 1st deadline, and we need to tell them that they have to wait because it is a statutorily set deadline. The other issue is that the current program in Minnesota requires individuals to live in that residence for 15 years before they can qualify for this program. And that probably made a lot of sense when the law was first written. But as we know, people move a little bit more frequently now and may have downsized as they became empty nesters. And so the governor's proposal and what is in the Senate bill moves that residency requirement in that home to 5 years. So that they could take advantage of this program. We believe that will help more seniors be able to take advantage of the program and make choices for themselves about whether staying in their home is the right decision for them and not have that be driven by being surprised by that second half property tax bill.
Thank you, Commissioner Bauer. Any questions for members on six? Okay, and I don't know if staff was able to put something to help research on some provisions that we have, or it's so extensive that they have to have more time to put it on paper. So we'll let them do that. So let's go to the Senate items 7, 8, 9, 10. And are these to Commissioner Bowerly, or are these to you, Senator Skoy? Okay, item 7, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the Senate has a few sales tax provisions that we really appreciate the opportunity to talk about during the time that you're chairing, Mr. Chair, because it helps the process move forward a little more rapidly, I believe. With regard to number 7, it's the Minnesota State High School League sales tax admission exemption. Currently, they have had this for a number of years. They use these sales. It's kind of an unusual use of a sales tax exemption in that they collect sales tax, then they put the receipts into a foundation. That foundation utilizes these dollars to promote high school athletics across the state, so they grant the money back out to high schools for high school athletic programs. We actually had this bill come before us another time, and we didn't quite understand the nature of the proposal and didn't do it then. The high school league explained it fully to us, and now we are convinced that it's a good thing for Minnesota high school athletics to grant this exemption. Senator Clausen carried it. And Ms. McQuay, do you recall what the cost of?
I have it.
Senator Rest.
It's Senator Rest.
$1.58 million in the first biennium, $1.67 in the second.
And Mr. Chair, those funds then are all, there's no administration taken out of them already. They all go out to Minnesota high school athletics.
Questions for members on item 7? I think that's pretty straightforward. Mr.
Thomas? Mr. Chair and members, I just wanted to point out that this is a dedication of funds. This is something that usually there is a policy not to have dedication of funds generally, and this would continue to have a dedication of funds. At one time it was limited, but this would continue this into perpetuity, so we just wanted to bring that up as your proceedings move along. That's a long time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, other questions for members or the department? 7, Senator Skoy.
And Mr. Chair, to the point, this did have an end date before. I mean, if the conference committee wants to contemplate 10 years or something, you know, I think the Senate would look at that as an okay change. We just thought for this conversation we would make it
go on and see where it goes from here.
Okay. It's in perpetuity until the next legislature does something.
Something like that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, item 8, Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, if I could let Senator Rest. This is a Senator Rest bill. So.
Certainly, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently, we exempt from sales tax the purchase of any number of items that are purchased for children, and just adds to that list. I mean, currently we don't put the sales tax on diapers, for example. And car seats, as you know, are required for children and babies. You can't leave the hospital unless with the child, the baby, unless you have the proper car seat. Some of them can be the booster seats. Perhaps are not as expensive, but some of the infant car seats can be very expensive. And so this is a adds to that list of products that we purchase for babies and little kids. And the cost of it, and the first biennium is $1.9 million for that exemption, and then the second, $2.2 million.
Questions for members on item 8? Comments from the department?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Thomas?
We put them in the memo.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you. Okay, item 9. Senator Scoy, who would take that?
Senator Kuna.
Senator Kuna.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, this is a bill I carried, and it's a sales tax exemption, originally for telecommunication equipment, all of it. But as we looked at it and took testimony in the committee as we heard the bill, the question was asked what was the most important equipment or most important stuff they would like to have exempted. And it ended up to be the fiber. Yeah. Yeah,
and conduit.
And the conduit. And so that's what we did in the Senate tax bill, then, is exempted those items. And it plays into also the state's goals of trying to make high-speed Internet accessible all over the state. And so if we're working towards that goal, why would we tax the fiber? So.
We know Senator Kuhn could have some help here on this. Okay, with what you've done here, what that cost is, and what would have been done to eliminate all,
Chairman, certainly on choosing those two items, it was $4.2 million and then $5 million. And I don't have the revenue estimate for the whole bill. I mean, we went through
the
there and just chose two that we thought were doable and that could apply in many, many communities.
Senator Scoy?
Mr. Chair, I can see that they're working to see if they can locate the original revenue estimate on what the original bill was. We, as Senator Coonan mentioned, kind of looked at with the effort to expand broadband. This is $7 million for that effort. The state put $20 million last year, I think, and that had an impact. So I think it'd be pretty significant help to the effort.
Okay. Item 10, and then I will go to a list of...
Mr. Chair, members, the original estimate to exempt telecommunications equipment, including wire, cable, fiber poles, and conduit, was 11.9 in the first year and 14.4 in the second year total. Excuse me, the general fund total would be 11.3 and 13.6.
Any questions for Ms.
McClay? Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelle.
Just make one comment on that, too. I know Representative Kreisha from my area and then Senator Schmidt on the other side of the aisle traveled around. We met them a couple of times up in my district, and this really would be a big, big deal because all of that money, if they're not paying that in taxes to us, they're going to plow back in and expand broadband even farther. And so I hope that we can I'm a strong advocate. The more we can do, the better. To me, in rural Minnesota, I think it is a lot like the old rural electric, where the fact is, you know, whatever help we can do to get it expanded into some of the deeper rural parts, the better off we're going to be. You know, everybody probably is aware, but it's just a reminder that if a small town does not have it, or any town does not have it, they're not going to compete with other businesses. They're not going to compete with their education systems, and their medical care is not going to be everything it could be. So whatever we can do to help, I think, is very important.
Questions for members? Oh, thank you. I guess I carried the bill in the House, the original one, and it was for the biennium about $26.3 million.
Okay.
So we have thank you, Ms. Templin. Comments on item 9 by the department?
We don't have any comments at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Item 10, local lodging tax. Who is kind of looking at that?
I'd actually like to turn to Representative Lencheski, but I suppose since it's a Senate provision, I'll do my best with it.
and we can all make comments on it, too. I mean, Senator Scoy.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Wicklund carried this bill. What's happening is, depending upon where you are in Minnesota, depends on how the lodging tax is being collected and implemented. And if it's state collected and administered, it's being administered one way. And if it's locally administered, it's being administered another way. And so when we looked at the issue, we weren't exactly sure which was the best way to go. But we knew that having the city of Minneapolis have one mechanism and the city of Bloomington have a different mechanism probably wasn't a good state policy. So we looked at this, and what's happening with regard to the lodging tax, if you walk in the door of the hotel and you book a room and it costs $100, you pay the lodging tax on $100. If you go online and you get the hotel room and it could still cost you $100, but the room component of it is $90, and the fee for facilitating the service of the booking is $10, then you pay the lodging tax on the $90. And so the Senator Wicklund's bill would change that so that the lodging tax would be assessed on the dollar amount that the end user pays. So it would include the service or whatever that part of the fee is. And if you look at this in the extreme, you know, a hotel could have a kiosk in their lobby where they would have bookings for, you know, $50 and a $50 fee, and then the lodging tax would be assessed on $50, whereas if you walked over to the desk and booked it regularly, the lodging tax would be assessed on $50. So we think there's an issue that needs to be resolved here. We have resolved it by having the lodging tax assessed on the amount that the customer pays, which would include the fee. But we really think that it's not a good state policy to have two large communities with very large lodging components being treated differently, and they're next to each other. And so we're trying to figure out how to resolve this, and this is our approach. And I don't know if Representative Lencheski wants to add anything or step into this or not.
But Chair Lencheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Scoy described that beautifully. And Mr. Chair, I just want to remind you, just to go back a little bit, when the bill I carried was heard, it was over time in the division. So the hearing only lasted a couple of minutes. So we really didn't have time to get into it. And I think Chair Scoy has summed it up very clearly. One other thing to think about is, you know, we just want what Bowabic has, because Bowabic has what Minneapolis has, too. So, you know, and Representative Swadzinski, you know, his community, Marshall, They're in the situation that Bloomington's in. So there's a this affects lots and lots of cities, and there's only a few who are receiving. Yeah, four, is that what it is? Who are receiving it one way, and it's because I think the state is the tax collector as opposed to the city. And then there's a different, you know, fairness issue within the tax, and I think Senator Chair Scoy has laid that out extremely well. And so, Mr. Chair, I will remind you that you are the chair, Chair Davids, that you implemented the change for Minneapolis in 2011. So I'm hoping in your wisdom you'll think it's a good idea. And, you know, it is a serious issue. It's not just a parochial issue. People in the Minnesota House know that Bloomington has the largest hospitality industry in the state, more hotel rooms per night than Minneapolis and St. Paul combined. And so it is difficult when we see cities like Minneapolis or Bowabic and a few others, their local convention and visitor bureaus and their local lodging receipts are enhanced in a way that their competitors are not. And from the consumer who's buying the room, whether you buy them online, you know, I tend to do the stuff online and do the cheap room and kind of be open to where it lands when I travel. But the consumer isn't even aware of this disparity. They're just getting a room. And so the person who's actually paying the tax isn't even aware that there's this disparity going on. So I hope by the end of this conference committee, the House can see its way to the Senate on this position. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lencheski. Senator Scoy. Chair Scoy.
Chair Davids, Representative Lencheski alluded to this, but these are funds that are used for promotion of the area. They're for tourism. And so they have a usefulness that benefits a broader area than just the local community, as you bring people from outside of Minnesota into Minnesota to recreate and visit the mall and go up to Lakes Country and, you know, all of that. It's part of our effort to recruit people to come to Minnesota to visit and enjoy our great state, but also be part of our state's economy. You know, tourism is a pretty big component of that, and these dollars are dedicated to that.
Thank you, Chair Scoy. Vice Chair Barrett.
Thank you. I just have a question about that. I'm looking at the summary here on page 47. It looks to be there's some requirements for local jurisdictions. I'm wondering if those requirements are significant or not necessarily significant as it relates to kind of a local, what it would take to implement this change in each of the jurisdictions. Is it significant or not? I'm not sure who the question would go to, but.
Is this a Ms. Dalton question?
And Mr. Chair,
or Chair Lencheski?
Mr. Chair, if I may, while Ms. Dalton will be able to add on to this.
Our provision.
When we, you know, and the Senate's carrying it, but it's, you know, the bill I carried, and what we heard, what I think happened a couple of years ago, I think there was an attempt to do this by another legislator who was in the same situation. I think it was St. Paul. I think it was Representative Lesh. I'm not sure on that. But we had testimony then that people came in and said, well, this would be so onerous because this is a small town issue. This isn't a Bloomington issue now because Bloomington has only 5 zip codes. But in these other affected communities, mostly rural, who would be helped by what Senator Scoy has in the Senate bill, some of the testimony said, this is hard for us to collect monthly because there's not that many facilities, or it's hard for us to know the zip code, so we're not even sure really if we're Expedia Orbitz or something to how to comply because it's just too much of an administrative burden on us to pay the tax. We don't mind paying the tax, but it was just too much of a burden. And so the legislation that I was just reading actually in your bill does give some comfort to, I'm not saying that they would support the bill, but some comfort to those complaints in that it affords two things to change, as you only have to collect the tax once a year, and it requires that any convention and visitor bureau community that, you know, would be afforded this equal treatment under the legislation would have to submit the zip codes for the intermediaries so they wouldn't have this administrative burden of trying to figure out how to comply. So Ms. Dalton might want to add to that.
And this is a Senate provision, so I should go to Ms. Pollack. To the Barrett question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barrett, is there anything that Representative Lincheski didn't answer that I could?
Vice Chair Barrett.
Maybe if you could give some comments, either supporting what Representative Lincheski said or adding on to, that would be great. If not, that's fine, too.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, in the Senate hearing, most of the testimony was that there is not one model that accommodation intermediaries use to price their services. And so their position is that it would be difficult for them to determine exactly what the increment was between the actual rate of the room and their service that they've provided that resulted in the total that the consumer pays. I think the Senate's position, and as Representative Lincheski mentioned, is that there's in Section 17 of the Senate bill, there's an additional accommodation, I guess you could say, for the local jurisdictions and the accommodations intermediaries to collect and remit the tax on a less frequent basis than is usually done under the state sales tax structure.
Does the department have any comments on this issue? Mr. Cummins?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the department is supportive of this provision. The department believes that this is a clarification to statute. This was found in our technical bill. We believe that whether you're going to get a hotel room from the hotel's website or from a hotel intermediary website, that this that the tax base should be based on sales price. Whether you're going to get some lodging from Minneapolis or whether you get it from Golden Valley, we believe the tax base should be based on sales price. So we think that this provision provides alignment, and we also believe that this is a clarification to our current policy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Cummins. If we adopted this, would then everything be the same for everyone in Minnesota, including tax collection? And, I mean, that's the part I'm not 100% clear on. The four cities that do it now, do you collect the taxes for them? So if we do this, all those other towns, would you be collecting taxes for them too? Is that how what I'm understanding?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do collect the tax for those four cities. This provision would not require any other cities to enter an agreement with the Department of Revenue to collect their taxes. There are provisions under current law that cities can enter into an agreement with the Department of Revenue to collect their local lodging taxes. But in order for this to turn on, they would have to go through the processes as outlined in the statute. Or under the proposal.
Let's go to Ms. Dalton and Representative Drazkowski. Ms. Dalton,
Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to maybe expand a little regarding Representative Barrett's question. There are 120 cities, towns, or city town, or partial county groups that impose a lodging tax under the general statutory authority. And as I said, because it could be a group of cities, it could be a group of towns, it could be unorganized territory within a county. That's why there's this language in that provision to basically require any organization that is imposing this tax to actually give the geographic information electronically to the Travelocities and things like that. So they can know where they're supposed to be collecting the tax. And it's because right now we don't actually know where all 120 of them are within the state because the state does not collect those taxes. They're all collected locally.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Lincheski, I apologize. I wasn't in the hearing that day when you presented the bill. But I'm trying to learn more about this, and we've had some discussions in the tax committee when we had the amendment offered, too. But is there not another way to I mean, certainly the consistency argument is somewhat compelling, but is this the only way to do it? Can you not instead take those handful of cities and put them under the general approach. Is that an option as well? And would that be less confusing and easier?
Is that to Ms. Dahlner?
Whoever would like to entertain.
Well, who wants that one? Ms. Dahlner, let's start with you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are a number, as I said, there's 120 of these local lodging taxes that are imposed under general law. There are a number of lodging taxes imposed under special law in addition to the four that are collected by the state. There is authority under the general law that says that anybody could go forward and enter into an agreement with the Department of Revenue. They have to negotiate the agreement, and then that would basically, as part of that negotiation, of course, the department would essentially have a collection fee, which is why most of these local localities that impose this tax have not been willing to go into an agreement with the Department of Revenue.
Thank you. Maybe Chair Lencheski can talk about that, but it seems you've got two different ways to go here, and the smaller number to deal with seems to be those that are doing the expanded model that this provision attempts to bring the other 120 towards. So it seems like we're swimming upstream a little bit.
Chair Lencheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Drazkowski, you could absolutely do what you just said. I thought about introducing a bill that just did it for Bloomington, and maybe at the end of the day you'll want to consider that. But it's really the cost prohibitive part for going into the state collection agreement is actually most of those other smaller communities. They're not going to want to pay the Department of Revenue the fee to collect the tax. Now, if you're someone like Bloomington, it's worth it to you to put that money into the department to get the return. But you'd still have the situation that all these other rural communities would not be afforded the equal treatment that some have now. But I do think even if you just said, let's reverse those four, first of all, you're going to hear from those four in a really loud way. But secondly, you haven't addressed the sort of sales tax policy question of, is the tax on the price, as Mr. Cummings was talking about, which in my estimation, I think consumers don't want to think, if I buy toothpaste, I pay this state sales tax when I walk into Walgreens. But if I order my toothpaste online, it's lost on the consumer. They're just paying the end price. And there's one competitor getting an extreme advantage over the bricks and mortars competitor. So I think even if you reverse it for the four, you have the fundamental tax policy question that, again, lost on the consumers, but it's a really unfair situation. So I just think there's a lot to think about in there.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Before we get too far in the weeds on this one, I do know that there are folks, and today's not the day for the testimony on that, but I do know there's some folks that have some concerns on this that we would also want to hear from and see what we can do here. Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lencheski, did you consider it all everybody being in the where the state collects for them, so that it's one uniform system? I can see that. I think this would probably help the Brainerd Lakes area, which is the east end of what I represent. But I'm thinking about smaller towns, and they may not want to participate and start advertising for one hotel in one town. I'm just wondering if you went through it and all thought about what if everybody was just on one system, then it's uniform. So your thoughts on that.
Chair Lencheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to take the conference committee's time in this much detail, but maybe Ms. Dalton could comment on that a little bit. I did, and I think this bill actually does that, really, is kind of affords everybody the situation to be their own collector. We could have them be with the state, but, again, they'd have to find the money. And I think Ms. Dalton could list off the top of her head, I will bet, a number of these communities, so you can just hear who some of them are. I think the fundamental problem for the small rural communities is you can't just ask the state, you can't go into a contract with the state to be the tax collector on local lodging without a fee. And I think some of these small city councils are just not going to find the resource. It's not worth the money for the two hotels or, the small hotel to get the receipt, which doesn't go to promote their hotel. It goes to promote the areas. So it's not really a benefit for to fill that hotel room. It's for the local convention and visitor bureau. So maybe Ms. Dalton could clarify some of those communities.
Ms. Dalton, what should we do? Or Ms. Dalton, could you clarify some communities, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, I cannot tell you all where all the local lodging taxes are off. I did start thinking about the Tofty area. There, I know there's three townships up in the Tofty area on the North Shore that have a joint one. I really don't want to try to do any of them by name because I'll forget some major ones. So I really don't have anything else to add at this point.
Okay, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe the department, do you know how much you charge for administrating these lodging?
Commissioner Bowerly, how much are you charging these poor little towns?
Mr. Chairman and members, we do charge a fee to administer local taxes because the department needs to recover its costs somehow. It turns out that our highly qualified people cannot work for free, so we do need to recover our costs there. I will turn to Mr. Cummings as he gives detail on what those arrangements look like.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, we do have a we do have a general formula that we use. We can provide that to the committee in terms of how much we charge for each community. But we can charge that to the committee, but I don't have that off the top of my head.
Okay. Right, that's the committee, that'd be wonderful. Chair Scoy.
Well, we have worked our way through the sales tax components. And
Senator Scoy, I'd like to go over briefly. I think it was a great idea what you did with the governor's items. If we might want to go through the House governor's items, if that's okay. Get some information on what we're looking like Monday, and we'll go from there. Unless there's anything else needs to come before the committee, Senator Scoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, we do have a couple other things we could add to 4 o'clock, and we'll see what time it is when we're done with the gov's stuff in the House. And
certainly, we'll pick up from there and see where we go.
See where we're at.
We have three more things we could
just clean them up, and then it would make next week look better and from there.
Okay, so House Research has prepared, you should have a handwritten document, a couple items here, and maybe just kind of go through the same procedure with the department here, describing what we have. In the House bill, we have, it looks like, five items. First one being the dependent care credit. I believe that was taken off the Loon bill at about $35 million, I believe it was. And the governor's original proposal was $104 million, taking about $124,000 per family. So maybe if you could just describe what the governor's thoughts are on item one, please. Sure. Mr. Bowers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. The Child and Dependent Care Credit is an existing credit in Minnesota, but right now the income cap is very low. It's about $39,000. And so right now only about 38,000 Minnesota families can take advantage of this credit. And we know that child care costs are not only something that is very important for families, making sure their children are safe and well cared for while they are able to go to work, but also it is an important element of early childhood education that is happening at many of these centers. And so the governor's initial proposal to invest about $104 million into this credit would have allowed 92,000 more families to access this credit. Mr. Chairman, we appreciate that the House included an expansion of this credit in the omnibus tax bill. As you mentioned, it's approximately $35 million, and I believe that got the income range into about $70,000 as the phase-out for those families. And so that does allow many more middle-class families to take advantage of the credit, and we do appreciate the inclusion of that provision in your bill.
Thank you. Questions from members on item one? And that was a big proposal from the governor. And I want to thank Commissioner Bowerly for her work on this going across the state and promoting this. Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what's the cost on that?
I believe it's $35 million.
$35 million.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Templin.
On the spreadsheet, it's on page 2, line 23. It's $35 million in the current and fiscal 16 and 17, and $38.4 million in the second biennium.
And that was, Senator Russ, that was pared down some at $104 million where the governor was at. You were up to giving people a credit, making $124,000 when it finally phased out. So we thought that was maybe a little much, but we like the concept, like the idea. And so that's what we put in. Of course, that's certainly up for negotiation
just
on that.
Just change the parameters.
I was hearing by Monday when we get our numbers, we may be from $2 billion up to $3 billion. So I just heard that. I don't know if there's any truth to that. Okay. Don't stop believing. Okay. Item 2, non-residents not claiming working family credit. Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair and members, I think it's good that we'll include these next items. The Senate has 2, 3, and 4 in our tax bill, and then number 5, I think, is in our transportation bill. But these are good items to get cleaned off our list for conversation. So,
very okay. Good. So let's visit about the Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, what we had done in our list was to provide governor's provisions that were not in a House bill. And,
okay.
I mean, this is fine to.
Well, maybe let's go quickly through these.
These. But we're familiar with them as well.
Okay, thank you. Senator Ress, item 2 to the department.
Mr. Chair and members, the second provision that was included from the governor's proposal, also in the House bill, is to eliminate the ability for full-time non-near residents to claim the working family credit. This allows what we believe to be the initial intent of this statute to provide working families in Minnesota, whether they be full-year Minnesota residents or part-year Minnesota residents, to access this credit, but not if you are a full-year resident of another state.
Any questions for members on item 2? Okay, item 3.
Item 3, Mr. Chairman and members, is regards the K-12 credit, and the governor has proposed increasing the income threshold for this credit so that more middle-class families can take advantage of this credit. The provision, the House bill has additional provisions related to the K-12 credit and the subtraction that are not similar to the governor's, but we do appreciate this as well, and I believe that the Senate bill as well has items related to the K-12 credit.
Questions from members? Item 4, CNG.
Item 4, Mr. Chairman and members, is related to compressed natural gas and aligning Minnesota's definition to the federal and international standard so that taxpayers in this group do not have to engage in additional calculation for the Minnesota tax and can just carry that down from their computation of tax owed in this space.
Thank you. Commissioner, questions for members on 4? 5. Commissioner Bowerly.
Mr. Chairman and members, number 5 is a clarification regarding the motor vehicle lease revenue to ensure that under the statute that it is clear that the legacy provision is accounted for. This is, again, a clarification to ensure that the statute is in keeping with the legacy amendment.
Okay. Questions for members on 5? The Senate had 6. I was hoping we had 7, but I guess we got 5. Oh, well. That's the way it goes. Sometimes you just have to live with disappointment. Okay, so that being said, we did also, Chair Scoy, have some same and similars, and we I want to take a look at a couple of those. So
Mr. Chairman?
Start building.
Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Bauer.
I would like to also point out that I believe your bill includes zappers.
That's right.
Sure.
Howard 6-6. We're going to get this thing signed yet. Okay. Did the Senate do zappers, Commissioner? Mr. Cummings?
It is. We understand it's on the general register, so it's not in the bill.
Separately.
Separate. Running as a separate bill.
I love that bill.
Signing ceremony.
Chair Scoy.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, if you would allow us just a few more minutes, we have 3... additional areas we would like to add in the income area. They're relatively small. I don't think they're going to take very long.
But if you would allow us, between Senator Rest and I, just a couple more minutes, we could clean that up, and then we'd go to the Sames and Sellers.
Absolutely.
I appreciate the indulgence. Sure, why don't you go ahead, Senator?
So, Mr. Chairman, the first one is found on page three of the side-by-side, and it has to do with changes that we made to the Greater Minnesota Internship Program.
Okay, Senator Rest, we go to...
It's our article on section two, and it's on page three of the side-by-side. And
okay, you're looking at your section two?
Yes, and what it does is to remove, take out the requirement that an employer has to verify or certify that it would not have hired the intern without the internship credit, and that a internship that's required as a part of an academic program does not qualify for the credit. So we made those changes to, and I'm not sure if that there's a Ms. McQuay, is there a cost on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, and members, there is a small cost. The first biennium has a $600,000 cost, and the second $800,000 in the second biennium.
Okay, Chair Sly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a new credit for interns for rural areas. It became apparent that we had tightened it up a little too tight, so it wasn't working very well. And making these changes, we think, will make the credit a lot more effective. As you know, we work to have college students have work experience as they're attending college to get an internship in a business anywhere in the state, actually. But this is primarily rural here. But we think the credit will work better if we can make these changes.
We're just taking out two. We're taking out two of the requirements that I just mentioned. That. We're not asking them to say that they wouldn't have hired the person except for the internship, and we're taking out the requirement that that it had to be the internship had to be an academic requirement. We just think that was not in the service of what we're trying to do for these kids that are in these programs.
Thank you. Item next.
You going to do them all, Senator Rest?
Or Senator Rest?
Sure. The second one is in our Article 1, Section 11, and it is film credit, film production credit, and this is on page 7 in the side-by-side. And this is it's line 52 on the spreadsheet. It's actually a modest film credit. We also have a provision in, I don't remember which appropriations bill, which finance bill.
Economic development.
It is. It's in economic development. And it takes us back to a provision that we've had before to allow to incentivize film production companies to come to Minnesota by allowing them a refundable credit of 25% of the qualifying expenses. And we define what that means, what a film is, and then making sure that they, whatever those expenditures are, that they have to be ones that would otherwise be taxed in the state. You can't use them for things that wouldn't be. And we make it effective in 16. I think it ends up being just a couple million.
Ms. McQuay?
Mr. Chair and members, the revenue loss associated with the credit is $1.6 million each year.
Each year?
And yeah.
Okay.
Then the last one.
Senator Rest.
Is a response to a constituent of mine who, and I know we all get these kind of emails that start out, how come I can file my individual income tax return with the feds at no charge through the service that I use, and a lot of people use TurboTax, but I have to pay $20, $30, whatever the charge is, to file the Minnesota return. And why can't we have free filing for Minnesota returns as well? And so I started a conversation with the department and discovered it's really not just a change in the law. It's more complicated than that because of the relationship between the department and the federal government with regard to data sharing, even though in Minnesota we require a federal a copy of the federal return to be submitted with your Minnesota return. But we use that information in developing our income tax models here for them to do the revenue estimates for. And so what we propose in our Article 1, Sections 30 and 32 page. Is page 14 in the side-by-side is a report from the department on the possibilities of free e-filing. And you might want to, you know, ask, well, why, how does it happen that TurboTax and some of the other softwares companies have free e-filing with the feds? Well, it's because TurboTax has a contract with the federal government, and the federal government pays for it. And so we're looking at how you can do that in Minnesota so that there's no charge to the taxpayer. The there are free filings, electronic filings, through departments, state departments of revenue or taxation, whatever they call them, through a portal on their websites, but it's very cumbersome because you have to do things like it's like a PDF, and you have to re-enter the information. Of course, what happens then is just like people who file paper returns, there are a lot of errors. And we want this to be, if it happens, we want it to be seamless, and the same information the information would only have to be entered once. And so what this provision does is simply to ask the department to explore with the vendors and look at what other states do, how they make it efficient, and to report back to the to the chairs of the two tax committees on the feasibility of doing that in Minnesota, with particular attention to the issue of the relationship between the IRS and the Department of Revenue with the information that would then become available under the, you know, the confidentiality rules and all that sort of thing. But I think that it would be end up being a real service to Minnesota taxpayers if they could just say, you know, send, and it would go, it would be free filing for feds and the free filing for Minnesota. And it's not just worth it to, you know, it's not just, okay, taxpayer doesn't have to pay another $20, but the biggest problem, or not the biggest, a significant problem for the, in terms of efficiency and cost for the departments of revenue, is paper filing. And that's where mistakes are made even now with people who continue to file paper returns. They're much more cumbersome to deal with. And by investing in free filing, we end up with, I think, we will discover that we end up with a savings to the state, because there will be far less, far fewer errors. So what this is asking for them to do a study. It's $175,000 to report back to you guys next year
with the possibility that it could be something that we would start in 2017, but it does not presume that we would do it. It just it's trying to find out whether it's worth it, whether it's efficient, whether it saves us money in the long run or even in the short run after we would do it. So I thought it was a really interesting discussion that I had with the department, and I'm trying to remember the lady who's the chair or who's the head of that, and I wonder, Commissioner Bowerly, what's her name again?
Assistant Bowerly.
Assistant Commissioner Terry Steenblock, who is our Assistant Commissioner for Individual Taxes,
yes.
We met with you.
She's very interested. She's been interested in this topic before and was we had a very nice conversation then when she saw the bill that I introduced to do this, and then went ahead and explained how much more complicated it was than my bill, which just directed the department to do it. It's not that simple.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Let's go to the department, then we'll go to member questions. Let's go to the department on the three items that the Senate has described to. Commissioner Bowerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and particularly Chair Rest. Thank you. We do want to thank you so much for the opportunity to do this study on Free File. It is something that we hear from our customers as well. And the vendors at this point in time do offer some access to free state filing based on income or perhaps for seniors, but we recognize this is something that many more Minnesotans would like access to. And as you pointed out, Chair Rest, it is really important to us to have a workable product, not just a PDF that someone fills out online and then prints off and sends into us. That is not what most customers these days think of as electronic filing. And so this will allow us to study the issues and explore options, and in particular, actually explore with vendors what those options might look like. It is helpful for us to deal directly with them because we would be using a vendor-based solution. We would anticipate the only solution that we – otherwise, many states are limited to this sort of PDF kind of solution. And then, of course, we would provide this report back to you for consideration and discussion as we move forward. And we know that, you know, it may be, you know, $10 or $15 for your vendor to file your state taxes, but we know that Minnesotans count their pennies, and so many people do choose to file on paper versus pay that fee to have it electronically. And the department is very interested in increasing the number of people who do file electronically. It has been growing over time. It is the fastest and most efficient and most effective way to get your taxes filed and any refund you maybe do back to you. So appreciate the opportunity to continue that good work. We just had one note on the film credit. As you may know, there's also a film production grant program that is also available, and so we do want to just make sure that this how these provisions would fit together would make it very accessible for filmmakers, for legitimate filmmakers who want to access, and we don't want to cause any confusion about any either program. And we want also to make sure that we can define who is eligible for this credit. So not just someone who may produce a YouTube video in their house, but actually filmmakers who have actual expenses, and so who would be taking this tax provision against their to promote film production here. So those are just a few of our comments, Mr. Chairman, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Bowerly. Questions for members? Okay, with that, Senator Scoy, did you have anything else? I think we had a couple same and similars. Unless we want to just defer this till Monday, or Senator Scoy?
Mr. Chair, I think we can act on some of the sames and similars. Should we just – I have a couple of comments I'd like to make, and then we'll see your reaction to
it. Certainly, certainly.
With regard to the first one on page 23 with the township assessors, after the bill was introduced, we had a number of meetings with the township associations and the DOR and kind of came up with some language that would work for DOR, and the township associations were pleased that we were involved in that would require 12 of these training meetings, 8 of them at their regularly scheduled summer meetings and then four additional ones. And so I think if we're going to do sames and similars there, we would want to try to take the Senate language. And on the other ones, I just have to turn to Senator Dietzick on the repurchase tax forfeit property provision, because Senator Dietzick has some concerns with that. The rest of them, we are fine adopting either the House or the Senate language. They're so similar, I don't think it matters.
Yes, Senator, what I was thinking was we probably leave the similars off for today,
okay,
because they may have some discussion needed. And then down at the, leave alone today the DMC issues, because those are going to need some attention. How about 24? What's 24? That is the same. Let's see, Applebaum, Bonner.
It's just changing the dates to make it more convenient for them to.
Mosquito control.
Does someone want to move that one?
I will, Mr.
Okay,
Chairman.
Senator Rest.
I would move
that we adopt 24.
Yes, and for the staff, on the same and similars, page 24, which is it will be adopting Article 3, Section 10 of the House bill.
Okay, we have the motion to, on page 24, adopt Article 3, Section 10. Discussion from members? Comments from the department?
We do not have any comments.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We're getting closer. Okay. I'll take part in this, too. I would move on page 47, Simonson bill, Reinert bill. I would move the Senate provision.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's easier for the staff if we if we're doing same and similars, we keep them in the same bill so that you would move the House.
Okay.
You'd move the House article.
Thank you, Senator. That's a very good point. So I will move the provision that's on page 47. I'll move the House language, Article 6, Sections 31 and 32. Discussion? Department? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The gentleman from Lyon moves. Representative Swazinski moves on page 50, Article 6, Section 29. That's the Marshall provision. House author Swazinski, Senate author Dames. Any discussion on that? Department?
No, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I suppose they should be asking for public testimony. Anybody want to testify on these provisions that are in my reelection campaign brochure? Okay, Senator Scoy.
Well, with concern about your campaign brochure, you did move over on page 59 the state auditor to have uniform reporting through all towns. Was that an advertent?
Let's wait on that one.
Okay.
Senator Rest, did you? What else do we have here?
We did Marshall?
Yeah.
Marshall.
And then not the DMC now?
I'd say wait on DMC. That's going to take a little bit of time.
Did you guys want to take a little more time to look at the Senate language with regard to the township equalizing? The assessor accreditation, or not assessor accreditation, I'll take a look at that.
I think the only one left there would be page 25.
Senator Dietzick had some issues with that.
Let's hold off on that.
Yeah. Well, I can explain it.
Oh, Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the language in the bill was the same, and I actually have a drafted amendment here, but we found a technical problem. And so is what the bill does is it set a rate so that for tax forfeited properties, and we did this last year, and then we tweaked it so that all properties, you get the lower tax rate when you do a confession of judgment. But some counties came to me, and they would like this just for residential property, because the goal was on the tax forfeited property when you go to get a confession of judgment and repurpose it, the goal was to do the get people back in their homes and keep home. People back in their homes for homestead property, not necessarily non-homestead property. Again, I represent City of Minneapolis, and we've had some problems where You have some landlords that use the county as their bank, and we would rather than the county doesn't want to compete with the bank, and so rather than them being the financer, where the person, and they know the, some of these landlords know exactly when that date is going to go tax forfeit and exactly when they have till to repurchase the property, and then they come in with a confession of judgment, and rather having the bank be the financer on that lower rate, we would rather have those people go to the bank, and the goal was to keep people in homes and, you know, homestead property. And so the amendment, which needs to be fixed, is to limit it just to the homestead property.
We'll need that in, we'll need that amendment in writing.
Yeah, there's an error.
And Mr. Chairman, that was
Chair Rest.
Representative Drazkowski's bill and mine. I'm sorry, that was Representative Drazkowski's bill and mine. And I think the parties have had an opportunity to speak with you, and they have with me, and I'm comfortable with the change that Senator Dietzick is proposing. But the language, we need to adopt the language and not an idea.
Both Strazkowski and Russ, it's got to be good. We know that. Yeah. So, but we'll get that cleaned up for next weekend. So with that, Chair Skoy and members, that's all we have. Would you like to let us know what's happening Monday?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think you will have the gavel. Today, according to the joint rules, the gavel switches every 24 hours on Saturday
even if we
and
don't
Sunday,
meet.
Even if we don't meet. So
that's
you,
what the rules say.
That's what the rules say.
I,
so
like those rules.
I would think you would like that. But, you know, you've been so generous with your time. We are no concern with that. So
I'm really not worried about the gavels. I just want to make sure we do it right.
No, but the gavel will be yours on Monday, and so whatever you think there.
And hopefully, members, hopefully we have some numbers. Then we can get this thing put together and call it a day. Just get that up to about $3 billion would be good. So with that, members, don't stop believing. Excuse me. Senator Skoy, you have the floor for an announcement on time.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's your announcement, but is there a time? Are we going to go after session? Did you guys want to come in the mornings? Just so people have an idea what the time is on Monday.
I should talk to staff here to see what actually works.
Yeah, session Monday afternoon.
Ways and Means is at 1.
Yeah,
we're at Ways and Means.
It's
1. Morning, but if you start at 11, we're going to lose you.
After session?
So just after session.
We're going to lose you if not a whole lot of sense starting at 10, shutting her down at 11. So
after session.
After the last body's done?
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be in the afternoon because we're at 3:30.
Unless something changes between now and then.
Yeah, so we should be done by Tuesday night.
I would think so.
But let's go. I'm looking at staff here to just see how this logistically can work. Half hour after the last body adjourns, because if we try to come in the morning at 9 or 10, I mean, I want to be respectful of folks that have a long drive in on a Monday morning. Let's go 1 half hour after the last body adjourns. And so be watching for your emails, members, so we can get that figured out. And with that, don't stop believing. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.